Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Some people who've lost a limb continue to experience the sensation of pain from that lost limb. What is going on in that situation? How is that possible? In addition, what can be done about the pain? Today, our guest is pain specialist Dr. Andrea Trescott, and our topic is unusual pain syndromes. Her very distinguished resume includes directorship in the past of pain fellowships at the University of Washington at the end of the University of Florida. She has published extensively in the field of interventional pain management and has co-authored a book that she gave me to me on her last appearance, Painwise, A Patient's Guide to Pain Management. Our most recent work on books is she was the editor of the textbook Peripheral Nerve Entrapments, Diagnosis and Management. Seems like a big deal, but I've noticed Amazon is now giving $15 off for each textbook you buy that's cost more than $100. And it deals with topics that are pertinent to today's discussion. She practices out of her office, the Pain and Headache Center in Eagle River, and sees patients there and in Wasilla and in Kenai. I last interviewed Dr. Trescott in September 2015 on the topic of chronic pain and the problems we're having with opioid abuse related to the issue of chronic pain management, a problem that continues to be a major health concern. So there is a link to that Line One program included in today's show notes, along with several links that are pertinent to today's program. Dr. Trescott is joining us from Florida, where she is coming to us by telephone. Dr. Trescott, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us again today.
Again, Thad, thank you so much for inviting me. It's always a pleasure.
If, while you're listening today, you have questions or comments, a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Toll-free number, 888-353-5752, and our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Trescott, let's start with a definition of pain, and then a very difficult question for you to answer, I think, is how pain is kind of perceived by the human body, a little bit of maybe the anatomy and physiology, or however you want to address that very difficult question to address on the radio.
And it is. I usually have all my audiovisual aids to be able to show pictures and patterns, right, and all sorts of things. But pain is a unpleasant response to a physical trauma or injury, or described in terms of that injury, burning, ripping, tearing. And it's important to recognize that though it can be in response to an actual stimulation, you step on a nail and it hurts, it can also be triggered by nerves that are firing off on their own out in the periphery. So a nerve can fire off and cause a pain signal, and it can be at the foot, or it can be at the knee, or it can be at the spinal cord level or at the brain level, and the brain will interpret that signal the same. And so it truly is that all, if everything you feel is in your head, the signals that come in from the periphery, from the skin and the muscles and the ligaments and the tendons and the joints, come in through a series of nerve pathways, and they come into the spinal cord, and they can go right back out the spinal cord again without ever being interpreted by the brain, and that would be a reflex, a spinal reflex. And that's why when somebody taps your knee with a hammer, your leg jerks, whether you have any control, and you have no control over that at all. That is considered a reflex. And there can be reflex responses. So when you step on the nail, you pull your foot back even before you've recognized that there's a pain involved with that. The signals then come to the spinal cord, and they travel up the spinal cord to an area of the brain called they travel in very specific portions of the spinal cord. They come in through a section of nerve bodies that's called the dorsal root ganglion, and then they connect in an area of the spinal cord, a whole variety of different areas, different signals come in and connect to different areas, and they do different pathways to different parts of the brain. But they all seem to come together at a part of the brain called the thalamus. And then from the thalamus, they go to the cerebral cortex, to the part that's actually involved with thinking and responding and perceiving. And so then the signal then goes back down again. And as it comes back down, this is where your body is able to modulate those signals. This is where you can turn down the gain of the signal so that you don't pay as much attention to it. This is where things like meditation, like antidepressants, like maybe even spinal cord stimulation. This is where opioids work. This is where acupuncture apparently has its effect. And that then decreases the perception of the pain and the suffering that goes along with the pain. But it's all really felt in the brain. It all comes from the brain. And so when we looked at things like phantom limb pain, we assumed since there was no foot, if your foot was hurting, it had to be because of something going on in the brain. So everything that's been going on for the last 150 years in treating phantom limb pain has been focused on the brain. There have been some newer mechanisms like mirror therapy, where if you trick the brain by looking in a mirror at the normal foot and making it seem like that's the missing foot, you can trigger the brain to think of it as the missing foot and control it, move the normal foot, and the brain thinks it's moving the missing foot. And a lot of exercises of trying to get someone to move that phantom limb because it feels like it's cramped. And so if you had a cramp, you move it, and it makes it feel better. Phantom sensations occur with everybody who has an amputation. And, in fact, people who are born without a limb will actually still feel as though there's a limb there. There's a phantom limb that seems to be imprinted in our brains. And you remember in medical school the idea of homunculus, that right. What portions of the brain can be assigned to various different portions of the body. And there's a portion of the brain assigned to the foot or the hand, whether you're born with a foot or hand or not. So that phantom sensation occurs in everybody. Phantom pain, on the other hand, is something very different. That's where there feels as though there's a pain, even though there's no limb there. Now, I started looking at phantom limb pain a little differently than everybody else does about 25 years ago, back when I was still doing anesthesia. I was doing a spinal anesthetic on a fellow who was getting a knee surgery. And to do that spinal anesthetic, you roll somebody over on their side, clean off their back, do the injection of local anesthetic, and then roll them, take the needle out and roll them back. And to speed things up, we would normally let the OR staff start to prep the leg in anticipation before everything got numb. So they would put the leg up in the air. I would put the drape up so the patient couldn't see what was going on. And they would prep the leg and then put on all the dressings and then put the leg down and start to operate. And one day, one of my patients said, "So when are they going to let my leg down?" Mm. And I said, "I'm sorry." He said, "Well, my leg's up in the air." And I said, "Oh, no, it's down on the bed." "No, it's up in the air." And I dropped down the sheet so he could see that they were busy operating on it. And he said, "Well, it still feels like it's up in the air. I still feel as though it's where it was when my leg went to sleep." And it stayed up in the air until the local anesthetic wore off. And it occurred to me that the brain is like the post office. It sends messages to the last known forwarding address. And the last time it knew where that foot was, it was up in the air. So then I started asking some of my phantom limb patients, pain patients, "Where are you feeling the pain?" And they said, "Well, in my foot." And I said, No. "Tell me exactly where on that phantom foot you're feeling it." "Well, I feel it in my big toe." "Well, the big toe is innervated by a very specific nerve called the saphenous nerve. And somebody else would say, well, it's the bottom of my foot. And, well, that's the sciatic nerve. And another person would say, well, it's across the top of my foot. And that's the peroneal nerve. And so then I started going back to the stump, and darned if they didn't have a nerve knot right where they were tended, where the nerve on the nerve that would have gone to the part of the foot that was bothering them. And so I started injecting that, and their pain would go away temporarily. And then I started freezing it with cryoneuroablation, and they would say, well, I was freezing it. They would go, I feel it in my toe. I feel it in my toe. My toe's numb. I feel it in my calf. I feel it in my calf. My calf's numb. I feel it in my knee. I feel it in my knee. My knee's numb. The pain's gone. And they would still feel the foot, but the pain was gone. And I didn't write it up, but I did write an article on nerve freezings in general. And about 5 years ago, 5 years after the article had been written, I got a cold email from a fellow in the Netherlands who said, great article on cryo, but you forgot to mention anything about phantom limb pain, because I found that if I have these phantom limb patients and I trace back where the nerve was that carries their pain signal, I can freeze it and their pain goes away. And I went, okay, that's two of us. I'm not crazy. And we're putting together a proposal with a group out of the University of California in San Diego, where we put in for a grant from the Department of Defense to specifically study phantom limb pain by freezing those nerves. But you have to be able to recognize the peripheral nerve. One of the reasons why I wrote that book on peripheral nerve entrapments.
How do you go about isolating which nerve it is?
It's pattern recognition. So each of these nerves goes to a different part of the body, and if you carefully question the patients and carefully mm-hmm. examine them, you can find these areas that are hurting. And mm-hmm. it is, in my book, what I spend a lot of time doing is I have actually drawn on my models, most of which were my daughter, bless her heart, where the pattern of pain is going to be for this particular nerve that the chapter involves. And the pictures of where they're going to be pointing, pictures of the pattern of pain that they'll have, pictures of the physical exam, and the diagnostic injections, because you can't treat what you can't diagnose. So we're now recognizing that a ton of headaches come from peripheral nerve entrapments, and a ton of arm pain and chest wall pain and abdominal wall pain and pelvic pain and low back pain and lower extremity pain are coming from identifiable, documented nerves that I was never taught and you were never taught, and I pretty much guarantee most patients' doctors were never taught about. But they're there, and the literature is there. It's just never been brought together all in one place, and that's what I tried to do with this new textbook.
I mentioned before we came on the air, I'd met Dr. Liu, another inner pain specialist that does a lot of what you do. It was either with him or something I read, I think it's also true that people who have more phantom limb pain are more likely to have the phantom limb pain if they also had pain in the limb before they lost the limb. Give the idea of that you mentioned beforehand, that the individual who last remembered where his leg was before he lost that, or they had the surgery or whatever.
Absolutely. So somebody with pain from diabetic peripheral neuropathy or gangrene, if that pain is not under control before the amputation, they have a much, much, much higher risk of having phantom limb pain afterwards. And we were able to show that this was 25 years ago even, and it still hasn't seemed to get through to the general medical community. We found that if you did an epidural, if you numbed up the leg for a few hours, ideally 24 hours, but even a few hours before the amputation, numbed it up, made the pain go away, these patients almost never had phantom limb pain. But if you didn't do that, their incidence of phantom limb pain was quite high. And so this is now a concept we're trying to generalize to look at something we're calling preemptive analgesia. So trying to get pain relief before you cause the pain. And this is for postoperative pain. People who are already hurting before they go into surgery, if that pain is not well managed before surgery and during surgery and immediately after surgery, they are at much greater risk of having prolonged surgery pain after surgery. And so we're trying to identify those people who are at increased risk and then try as much as possible to prevent that from escalating to a chronic pain problem. And my chronic pain patients I think of as being dry tinder, and the spark is the surgery. And you can get a raging forest fire if you don't try and treat these patients ahead of time. Before the day before surgery, they need to be getting certain medicines and certain treatments to try and prevent pain. And so, unfortunately, we normally see patients after the fact when the fire has already been raging, and it's much, much harder to treat then.
Let me take just a second to remind listeners you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Andrea Trescott. We're talking about unusual pain syndromes. Right now we're talking about phantom limb pain, but we're going to talk about something called chronic regional pain syndrome in addition to perhaps some other topics. If you've got questions or comments, our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1, and you need to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. And we have a toll-free number, 888-353-5752. I'm guessing then that a very large percentage of patients who have to have a limb amputated because of disease have some pain that leads to that amputation, so that it must be a fairly common phenomenon, and I was thinking this was pretty unusual.
No, unfortunately it is very common, and it isn't something that the patients, they're told, well, that's what is expected, and so they don't complain about it.
Right.
They don't know there's anything they do. They suffer in silence.
Right.
It's like the pain from shingles. It's like the complex regional pain syndrome, or CRPS, that you were describing. We can talk about shingles for just a second because that's one of my passions. Shingles, as you know, is the chickenpox virus that sits in your body for the rest of your life, and it lives in the nerve roots. And then for whatever reason, you've gotten older and your immune system forgets what the virus looks like, or you've got a stress in the system and your antibodies are all busy fighting off something else. I think of this shingles virus as being a prisoner, and the guards get old or they get called off to something else, and the virus breaks out of its prison and goes raping and pillaging along the path of the nerve it was living in. And the body, that's what then comes out as shingles. So the chickenpox virus and the shingles, it took many, 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 many years to recognize that they were the same virus. So the shingles comes out. It's interesting, the pain from shingles is not from the rash. You can have pain for up to 100 days before the rash comes out. The pain from shingles comes because the body's response to that virus is to shut down the supply lines, just like any good general would do, is to cut the bridges. The body shuts down the blood flow to the nerve, and that leaves the nerve without oxygen, which we call ischemia. And when you don't have oxygen to the heart, it hurts. When you don't have oxygen to the toe, it hurts. When you don't have oxygen to the nerve, it hurts. And there are multiple types of nerves that are in a nerve bundle. And the ones that are the most sensitive to that lack of oxygen are the ones we call the modulator nerves, the ones that tell the pain nerves not to fire off. So if you already have a lack of blood flow, you're older, you've got peripheral vascular disease, the blood vessel, the nerve blood vessels themselves are already compromised, or you've got diabetes or any of a variety of things, so if you've already got compromise, if you've got a lot of pain because that pain causes the body's response to that pain is to shut down the blood vessels. That's why you go white with fright or white with pain, is the body shutting down those blood vessels. Or if it goes on for a longer period of time, for whatever reason, those modulator nerves start to die. And once they die, the pain nerves start firing off on their own or with the lightest touch. And that then becomes what we call post-herpetic neuralgia. And the pain after shingles has been identified as the second leading cause of suicide in people over 70 years old. Now, if what you do is during the acute attack of shingles, the acute attack, if you restore blood flow to those nerves, and it can be simple as a nerve block, it can be an epidural, it can be topical medications, whatever it is that restores blood flow to that nerve quickly, not only does the nerve get blood, but if you're giving somebody antivirals or they have their own antibodies and the supply lines have been shut down, how does the body get those medicines to the right area? Well, it can't. But these, if you restore blood flow, now the antivirals and the antibodies can get out to the area. The lesions, the sores heal within days, 24, 72 hours. It's really amazing. The pain goes away instantly, and they don't develop post-herpetic neuralgia. If, on the other hand, you wait until after the sores have healed and they're still hurting, well, by then it's like starting CPR when somebody's been down for an hour. There's just the chances of being able to bring them back are very, very, very poor. And so that's one of the heartbreaks of shingles, is that it can be treated early, but it almost never gets treated early. People only get sent to pain management after they have continued to hurt after the sores have healed.
So this is really new to me as well, and I have friends who've now had shingles and significant post-herpetic pain. What I need to be telling them is next time you start an attack, and they may, is they need to address that very quickly to prevent the
post-herpetic. And unfortunately, the antivirals don't prevent the post-herpetic neuralgia. I've got a beautiful graph from the 1940s where it shows the incidence of post-herpetic neuralgia going up with age, which we've identified. And superimposed on that was a similar study done in the 90s. Well, acyclovir, one of the first antivirals, was introduced in 1983, and there was no change in those two lines. Mm-hmm. So it makes the sores heal faster, that's clear, but it doesn't seem to decrease the risk of post-herpetic neuralgia. So I put people on antivirals, but I give them injections right away.
Yeah, so that makes sense. I mean, you're affecting the infection, but the damage has been done.
Correct.
Basically.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so that's the same sort of thing we're seeing now with complex regional pain syndrome. This was a condition that was described by Silas Mitchell in the Civil War. He was a surgeon who recognized that these soldiers who were injured with high-velocity bullets, it was the first time we had high-velocity bullets, would have damage to the nerves in the arm or in the leg, and they would have pain way out of proportion to the actual tissue damage that was seen. And they would come in with their arm wrapped, unable to tolerate even the lightest touch, and he coined the term causalgia from the Greek word meaning burning. It was then recognized in the 1940s that it was related perhaps to the sympathetic nerves, and so it was called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, meaning bad growth, because the patients would completely immobilize that limb to try and keep the pain under control, and then was renamed complex regional pain syndrome in the late 80s, early 90s. We've still been looking at it as being a problem of the sympathetic system, and so the main treatment has been to try and numb up the sympathetic nerves, the ones that make you go white with fright, pupils dilate, heartbeat faster. But what we're recognizing is that it has to be triggered by something, and a group of us now believe that trigger is a recognized or unrecognized nerve injury, that it can be one of these peripheral nerves that, when it's injured and entrapped, the body's response to the injury actually makes the entrapment worse. It's a little bit like a building with a fire in the corner. the building senses the fire and turns on the sprinklers, and that water puts out the fire, unless it's an electrical fire, in which case water is the worst possible thing you can do, but the building doesn't know the difference. The body's response to an injury is to turn on the sympathetic system, which decreases the blood flow and the swelling, but also decreases the blood flow to the nerves, which then makes the nerves have the risk of ischemia and pain and setting up then a vicious cycle. So again, early treatment, trying to put out that fire when it's a small fire, and recognizing where the pathology is and directing your therapy exactly there can shut these down very quickly. Unfortunately, most of the time when we see the patients, again, it's far too late. The limb has been consumed. The limb is totally useless. And we then have to look at medicines that work all over the body. We look at spinal cord stimulators. We look at putting pumps in the spinal fluid. We look at medicines like ketamine and some of the anti-seizure medicines and topicals, and trying to get people to be able to tolerate the physical therapy that would be then necessary to try and get the limb functioning again.
I still have some questions about phantom limb, and we've gotten on to the complex regional pain. So I think right now, Dr. Truscott, what I want to do is I want to take our typical break for about a minute and then come back. And I want to come back to phantom limb, but then I want to move on to this complex regional pain syndrome a little bit more, and then maybe delve into the whole issue of these nerve entrapments for the rest of the day. But let me go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be right back with you. Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a one-minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion with Dr. Andrea Truscott on these unusual pain syndromes. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is unusual pain syndromes, problems like pain and missing limbs, and debilitating a pain that occurs sometimes after very trivial injuries. My guest is Dr. Andrea Truscott. She's a world authority on pain and pain management. We're lucky enough to have her in Alaska. She practices out of her office in Eagle River, the Pain and Headache Center. She also sees patients in Wasilla and Kenai. You can email your questions to us over the next 30 minutes or so at line1@alaskapublic.org. We also have a local number to call, 550-8433, 550-8433. And one more number, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Please remember that if you're listening to this broadcast between 8 and 9 on Monday evenings, you're listening to a tape rebroadcast, we won't be able to take your phone calls. However, Dr. Truscott has been generous enough to say that she'd be more than happy to answer patients' questions. If you have them, and it's, I think, it, Dr. Truscott, tell me if it's wrong, but I've got drtruscott@gmail.com. Is that the right email address?
That's the right email address, yes, sir.
And it's dr. Dot, for doctor?
Nope,
or
drescott.
Yeah, with one T on Truscott at gmail.com. All right, and I would strongly recommend if this program is making sense to you and is of interest, go to our program notes at alaskapublic.org. There's several links that I think you'd find beneficial and useful as well. A couple of questions that still come to my mind about phantom limb syndrome in particular. What is the natural history of untreated phantom limb pain? So what I'm getting at is, does it naturally eventually go away? Is it lifelong? And then, well, then I'll ask the next question after you address that one.
You'd be surprised. There has not been a very good study about the natural history of phantom limb pain, though many pain syndromes eventually burn themselves out, or the patients commit suicide, or they get eventually seek more aggressive therapy. And for most people, we can get the pain managed. That's why we call it pain management and not pain cure. We're trying to, and that may be with high-dose opioids or with high doses of anti-seizure medicines. We use the anticonvulsant or anti-seizure medicines because nerves that are firing off on their own inside the brain cause seizures, and nerves that are firing off on their own outside the brain cause stabs of pain. And even if it's coming from inside the brain, you can sometimes keep those nerves from firing off. So the anti-seizure medicines have been very helpful. And then anything you can do that decreases or that either decreases the signals coming in, so things like spinal cord stimulation where you exchange pain for tingling. That's why, by the way, nerves can only carry one signal at a time, and if they're busy carrying a non-painful signal, then the painful signal can't get through, which is why when you bang your shin, you rub it, because the rubbing blocks the pain signals. So spinal cord stimulation, peripheral nerve stimulation, we can try and kill the nerves that are going to those areas. We look at blocking pain signals at the brain level with the opioids, and then anything that can help block out pain. So everyone knows that when you're doing something you enjoy, it's easier to block. You don't recognize, oh, gee, you know, I've been sitting here for an hour and didn't know it. I got in this position and it didn't hurt because I wasn't paying any attention to it. And the problem comes in is that when you're hurting, you get depressed, and depression, by definition, keeps you from doing the things that you enjoy, so it makes this vicious cycle because you don't do the things you're enjoying, would normally enjoy because you're depressed, and that leads to decreased blocking out of pain and increased pain, which leads to increased depression. We have to deal. So the natural history, as I said, was that these patients may get somewhat better over time. The brain can only take so much. It can only handle so much coming in. And at some point, the sections of the brain start to shut down and shut out. But unfortunately, so many people suffer for years and years and years and years and years.
I came into the program, and before you introduced me to your textbook, impressed with the description by a neuroscientist named Ramachandran about the use of mirrors in fooling the central nervous system under impression of pain for phantom limb. And now I'm wondering, the question in my mind is all phantom limb pain peripheral in origin? I'm choosing my words carefully. Or yeah. Is it still that there might be central mechanisms in place?
Well, there's certainly central modulation. The brain has a remarkable ability to shut out pain. But just think of the people who are able to walk on hot coals with enough or have lay on a bed of nails when they're meditating. But and I obviously have a bias toward the peripheral nerves, but it has been remarkable in my practice how many times I've been able to identify a peripheral nerve. And I think of it as being the part that sustains the problem. You've got this barrage of signals coming into the spinal cord. And as long as those signals are coming in, it's hard for the brain to block those out. If you can turn that down, turn the volume down, shut off the fire, mm-hmm. put out the fire, the alarms may still be ringing. You still may have to go to the outside of the building and shut off the power. But as long as the fire is still burning, it doesn't matter how many times you shut off the power to the building. As soon as the power comes back on, the alarms are going to be ringing again, and those alarms are going to drive everybody nuts. And so I think you have to shut down whatever it is that's continuing to perpetuate the problem. You have to take the splinter out of the foot if you're going to continue to walk on it and make it worse. And if you can use all the modulation and all the biofeedback and all the acupuncture and all the therapies you want to do, but if that splinter is still in the foot, it's still continuing to trigger pain. So after a while, we think there's a condition called central sensitization, where now there have been signals long enough that even when you take the splinter out, the brain still feels the pain. And there may be a large component of that. But again, you still have to treat the underlying process before you have any hope, I think, of turning down the central portion of the brain, at least effectively.
One of the lessons that I think I'm coming away from this with, although it doesn't affect my day-to-day practice, is that if there's going to be surgery for pain, and you tell me if I'm overgeneralizing here, then control of the pain before the surgery should be done by surgeons prior to the surgery to decrease the likelihood of post-operative pain.
Would you say that again? I wish I could get the other physicians in the community to hear that. No,
oh,
you're absolutely right. And that's,
yeah.
that's sort of my sermon on the mount to
wow.
try and
yeah.
to get the medical community to understand how important it is to prevent pain,
right.
especially in those patients who are already hurting, because right. their system, they're already at DEFCON 1. They're already aruga, aruga. Every neuron is already on general alert, mm. and it doesn't take much to set that off.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to ask you one quick question that is not necessarily pertaining to what we're talking about now, but I had an email, and then I want to get back to the complex regional pain. This is an email that from an individual says, I virtually never get any pain relief from over-the-counter pain medications, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like aspirin, yeah. ibuprofen, acetaminophen, aleve. Not for injury, back pain, headache, and so forth. Mild opiates such as tramadol have been effective for acute back pain and works better when mixed with acetaminophen, I think is what he's trying to say here, although he didn't spell it very well. So his question is, why doesn't my body react to non-steroidal anti-inflammatories?
Well, pain, we think, is caused by inflammation, and that's why we look at anti-inflammatories. But nerve pains mm-hmm. don't do well with anti-inflammatories because it's not an inflammation. It's what we call a neuropathic pain. And tramadol is a very, very interesting medicine. It's a mild opioid. It's a mild narcotic. But it also has, it's a serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, which means that what it does is it increases the chemicals that are supposed to be in the brain, serotonin and norepinephrine, that are involved with blocking out pain, specifically pain from nerves. So my guess would be that his problem is a nerve pain and not a inflammation pain, and that's why anti-inflammatories don't help.
Okey-dokey. Thanks very much. Now, what got me to this program and to Dr. Trescott again was listening to a podcast called Inside Health. Again, the link to that is on our program notes. And there was a discussion of complex regional pain syndrome, which Dr. Trescott has already mentioned a little bit. But I want to read just briefly the transcript of the individual who was suffering from this disorder, because I think it's amazing to me the kind of pain these individuals may have. So if you bear with me, let me get to this. Now I lost my place. Way to go, Dr. Woodard.
Always hard.
All right. So the individual says, it started when I fell over playing tennis. I played a beautiful slice, backhand, my feet slipped, my hand went down, and my distal humerus shattered. I was in the hospital for a few days. Part of my ulnar was taken off. I had some plates and screws and wires. The first thing I noticed afterwards was swelling, particularly of my hand and my wrist. It was like a rubber glove that had been filled with water with little sticks for fingers. And it turns out to look kind of like salami. It was very hot. This happened over about 7 days. There was intense pain in my wrist. Felt like my hand was being crushed in a vise and hot water was being poured over it. 2 weeks after the operation, the pain was so bad that I was considering taking my own arm off. I had a scalpel in my bed. I was in two minds whether to take it off or not. I had a sheet in my mouth to stop screaming. It may sound very strange, the fact that I wanted to amputate my own limb, but nothing was helping. I'm in a state of absolute desperation. So I have seen one patient in retrospect, 1980s, a little girl that had a similar situation, very unusual, very out of the expectation of pain, with wasting of her arm because she didn't want to use it. I don't remember the injury at all. And I have to bring up the fact that because we couldn't understand it, I couldn't understand it, I was very concerned about some psychological reasons. However, I had to admit that she was having wasting and temperature changes and color changes in her arm, which made me still wonder, what in the hell is going on here? I think both of these are examples of this complex regional pain syndrome that you've been discussing. Am I
absolutely
correct?
You're absolutely right. And these patients get blown off as malingering, as symptom magnification, as wusses. Oh, come on. You know, it's just a trivial injury. That's the worst one. There's one patient that I've dealt with who was simply was shaking hands with somebody and they shook her hand tightly and it triggered an injury to the point that she's now 3 years later and cannot use that arm. It can be, and that's part of the problem. If you at least had a broken bone, you say, okay, you know, it was a broken bone, but this pain that is out of proportion to the injury that is sustained past the length of time expected for healing. These are all characteristics of the CRPS. And it is characterized by this potentially dramatic swelling, temperature changes, sweating, skin changes, nail changes, changes in color. We talk about the red, white, and blue. It'll be red, and then it'll go pale, and then it'll get bluish discolorations, and that can happen. Change, we call it vasomotor instability, the blood vessels, the nerves that control the size of the blood vessels will clamp down or dilate or in just a matter of minutes. There's a acute sensitivity that we call allodynia, where even the lightest touch can be excruciating. There's also a term called hyperpathia, where you might squeeze it and it hurts, but then that pain, which should go away in a few seconds, instead lasts minutes to hours. And so it has been a condition that has puzzled doctors since the Civil War, and we still do not have a good handle on it. The good news is that people are starting to make the diagnosis. And it's interesting. I'll see now a fair number of patients who will be sent to me with CRPS that don't actually have it. They have something else that's mimicking it. But thank goodness they're being sent. I don't care why they're being sent. They're just being sent. And it, that gives me, as long once they've been sent, it gives us a chance to be able to do something about it. It's the patients who are blown off, whose cast gets too tight, whose the ankle sprains are a big one. The trauma that happens to the nerves from ankle sprains. In the gentleman's case you described, it's light, that kind of damage that goes to breaking bones right along the ulnar nerve travels right along that bone and is very likely traumatized during surgeries like that. It's a devastating, under-recognized. You had talked about it being a rare, unusual, and I think it's more that it is under-recognized and under-diagnosed and attributed, blown off to being psychogenic. And that's what we do with everybody. When we don't know what the problem is, it must be all in their head. I can't tell you how many patients I felt like I needed to apologize years later when I recognized what, by finding other patients, I finally recognized what theirs must have been.
And so today, circling back to this peripheral nerve, it's felt to be and pretty clearly related to peripheral nerve injury of one sort or the other, entrapment injury to them. And then if we can address that area of pain, we can control this problem.
Well, I'd like to think it was that easy. But certainly the first step is identifying the trigger. If you can figure out, I think of it as a gas main that's leaking. You're trying to put out the fire, but if you can't identify where the leak is in the gas main, you're not going to be able to put the fire out. Now, once you've shut down the gas main and you've shut down the leak, you've still got to put the fire out. Lighting a match and setting a fire, blowing out the match doesn't put the rest of the fire out. But you can't possibly get it under control while there's still continued triggers, much of which I believe very strongly are due to peripheral nerve entrapments.
Let me ask the natural history again. I have read that the natural history, or at least following in that podcast that I mentioned, the nerve specialists that were being interviewed with that gentleman from England were saying that typically 6 to 12 months, many but not all, are better. And that makes me think of the time it may take for peripheral nerves to heal themselves. Is the natural history here better known? Does that make sense? Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that in the same way that most patients with postherpetic neuralgia will get better within a year. Well, that means, though, that they suffered for a year with that pain, where it could have been treated.
Right.
So leaving these alone and hoping that they will get better, I don't think is the appropriate treatment.
Okay.
Because a group of them won't, and you've lost then the window of opportunity for trying to reverse the potential damage. So, yes, it may go away on its own. And that's one of the problems. It's like treating multiple sclerosis. If you've got a condition that goes away on its own or has relapse, will spontaneously get better, then it's hard to tell what it is you're doing, whether that's what's made things better. But I do believe strongly that these patients, these conditions, and more importantly, these patients need to be treated aggressively, even with shingles. Most patients with shingles will get better on their own, but the ones who don't are dealing with months or years of pain, and when it's a relatively simple thing to treat them early and much more difficult to treat it late.
In the podcast from Inside Health, which is an English podcast, they mentioned, or the individual mentioned, that what helped him over time was physical therapy, which I've read in other situations. Where would you place physical therapy, or is it in the therapy, or does it depend exactly what has happened to the peripheral nerve?
Getting the nerve mobilized. These nerves are supposed to be moving smoothly. You can think of a nerve as being your arm, and it's path as being the sleeve. And the sleeve, the arm is supposed to move smoothly in the sleeve. And when it gets trapped, if you burned your arm and put that shirt on, it would stick. And then every time you moved your arm, it would pull and tug. So physical therapy is a critical part of this. Unfortunately, if you can't tolerate the physical therapy, it doesn't do you any good. So one of the roles of pain management is to provide enough pain relief to be able to do the physical therapy to get better. You can't rehab somebody who's hurting. And that's true whether we're talking about low back pain or CRPS or any of a variety of painful conditions. But the physical therapy by itself, unfortunately, is often causes more pain, which turns on the sympathetic system, which makes everything worse. And people don't do things when it hurts. That's what the, you know, they recognize pain as being something to tell you not to do that. So it's, I think, important to recognize that though physical therapy is important in that, you have to have the pain relief to do it. And I was going to, I have a quote that I think is one that I end most of my lectures with, and it talks about pain, and especially this was written about CRPS, and it says, in a very short period of time, it will convert the brightest spirit into a being haunted, driven upon himself, thinking only of his disease, selfishly indifferent to everything and everybody, and constantly obsessed by recurrent spasms of pain. This was written by a Dr. LaRoche in 1934 about CRPS, what was called reflex sympathetic dystrophy then.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners, we are talking with Dr. Andrea Trescott, a local pain specialist, actually a well-recognized authority worldwide on pain. If you've got questions or comments, we've got about 5 or 6, maybe 7 minutes left. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Trescott, so you've written a whole textbook on nerve entrapments, peripheral nerve entrapments. I've looked through the book. I've read the parts on reflux or chronic regional pain and the phantom limb. And now I'm sitting here thinking of chronic pain syndromes otherwise, and the one that comes to my mind the most is, or as quickly, is the pain that may be sustained after car accidents in the neck, the whiplash kind of injury. And it's notoriously drives probably orthopedic surgeons crazy. Where am I overgeneralizing? Where would you take that symptom right now?
I want you in my practice. This is, you're absolutely right. This is one of the things that causes a tremendous amount of problems. And because there are no broken bones, because in the past there have been malingerers who describe, my back, oh, my neck, oh, I'm disabled, and from what were viewed as trivial car accidents. It turns out that when you have this, what we call flexion extension, the head is typically thrown forward and then thrown back, a couple of things happen. The ligaments that hold the bones of the neck together get stretched. And now this 12-pound head that's supposed to be on a nice inward curve of the neck now is the you tend to hold your head forward because that takes up the slack in the ligaments, just like you would poke out if you had a pair of pants that were too big, you'd poke out your stomach so the pants wouldn't fall down. That makes then the muscles that are trying to hold up this 12-pound head, which now, from a mechanical point of view, is now weighing 30 pounds or 40 pounds equivalent. They're trying to pull the head back up again, so the muscles go into spasm. The joints of the neck, which are called facets, now move too much. It's like you hit a pothole with your car, and it throws off the alignment. Now you've got to shimmy and increase wear and tear on the tires. And then the biggest muscles there in the neck, called the trapezius muscles, attach at the base of the skull right where the greater occipital nerve attaches. In fact, the nerve goes right through the attachment of this muscle. So when the muscle goes into spasm, it entraps the occipital nerve, which then causes headaches. And so, yes, it's a peripheral nerve entrapment. It's a whole sequence of events that occur. And because it doesn't show up as a herniated disc, it may show up as a bulge, because with the head held forward, you've got a forward pressure on the disc, and it makes the disc bulge back. So the disc bulges, but that's not where the pain's coming from. The pain's coming from the facets, the ligaments, the muscles, and the nerves that get entrapped because of that. So you have to treat that whole complex, none of which shows up as a broken bone, none of which gets read by the radiologist as being a problem. And we do trigger point injections of the muscles, but that's fine, except the muscles are doing what they're supposed to do. We do facet injections, and it makes the pain go away temporarily, but we haven't treated the instability. So there, you've got what was a simple slam on the brakes, head goes forward and back, or you're sitting at a stoplight and goes backwards and forwards. Ends up being then a devastating problem. And then they hurt, so they don't sleep. When they don't sleep, it causes more muscle spasms and more depression, and you get this very downward spiral. It's interesting, though, there does appear to be a component of victimization here. When a car accident, when you've got a hitter and a hittee, it's amazing to me that I see the hittees, but the hitter should have the same sort of flexion extension injury, and I don't see those patients.
Right.
So I don't know. There is a role for the victimization as well that makes everything worse. I was sitting at a stop sign and somebody hit me. And so the victimization is a big part of this as well and has to be addressed.
Quickly, I want to make sure I've got your right contact information. It's Dr. Trescott, T-R-E-S-C-O-T at gmail.com, but it's dr.trescott for doctor?
Nope, okay. Not dot. So it's what I usually do is do capital D, little r, capital T, R-E-S-C-O-T.
All right.
And
One more quick question. I have somebody who's sent in or has a call, and I'm not going to be able to take it, but I'm going to guess their issue. She or he had a epidural, and a nerve was apparently hit, and they must be having some persistent pain. Does that how would you explain that?
Okay. So the nerves come out from the spinal cord, and they head out to the legs, and they travel in the spinal fluid, and then they travel out through the openings of the bones called the foramen. And when they're traveling out through the foramen, they end up being stuck. Well, they can't move out of the way. So when you're putting a needle in, and this is likely to have been a blind epidural for labor, would be the most common thing we see with that happening, because you have bone landmarks, but you can't see by fluoroscopy exactly where you are. And those patients, the laboring epidural patients, are much more likely to have these nerve pains afterwards. So
right.
It can be treated. It just needs to be identified.
All right. If that caller has problems, Dr. Trescott, T-R-E-S-C-O-T at gmail.com. Thanks very much. I thoroughly enjoyed it, especially because I continue to learn new things. I wish you the best and hope to you get back up here safely.
Thank you, Dad. Appreciate it. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Next week, Prentice will return with a discussion on anger and its impact on relationships and health on Monday, January 16th. Eric Bark was our engineer today, and he's also our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.